Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the JMO Podcast. I'm your host, Taylor Michaels, and our guest this episode, we've got Joe Okada back on the show. We had Joe on for the first time, like, really early this spring, almost, like, before a whole lot of open water fishing had been had, and that was a long time coming. It was actually the first time I had him on, but I've been a fan of Joe's for a long time. He's got a lot of friends in the industry. He's got a great reputation. He's been fishing a long time, and, he's probably most notable for his tournament exploits. He's been fishing tournaments for a long time on a really high level, but he's also got some great YouTube content. We kind of highlighted that last time as well. And he's just an all-around great guy. He fishes all the time. So whatever he wants to talk about, I'm in. He's had some really, really cool tournaments. He's fished some really cool tournaments out here in the Dakotas and in eastern Montana on the Missouri River system this year. He had a really cool tournament out west on Fort Peck, fishing the Montana Governor's Cup. And his fishing partner for that was a legendary tournament angler, Brett King. So I wanted to get that story, and just it was Joe's first time fishing out there. And for somebody like Joe Okada that's been fishing tournaments all over the place, you know, basically anywhere walleye swim, there's not many destinations out there, or at least notable like tournament destinations that Joe hasn't quite fished yet. And this is one of them. He'd never fished Fort Peck before, actually. So no waypoints, no preconceived notions, just going out there to try to tackle it for the first time. And I just think it's a really, really cool story. So I'm glad we were able to finally have it. So let's get to it here. We got Joe Okada, and we're talking Fort Peck walleyes.
The fishing opportunities across the state of Montana are phenomenal. If you're from there or you've already been there a bunch to experience it, you know just how special these opportunities are. If you haven't, fishing out west should absolutely be on your bucket list. But aquatic invasive species like zebra mussels and Eurasian water milfoil can harm recreational opportunities. As boaters, as anglers, we have the ability to help protect Montana's waters by cleaning all mud, plants, and debris off our boat, recreational equipment, and fishing gear before we leave any access sites. Drain the water from your motor, your live well, your bilges, and allow your boat and equipment time to dry before your next outing. No matter what watercraft you use, please, if you're traveling in the state of Montana, stop at all inspection stations. Together, we can protect Montana's waters. Visit the link in the description of this podcast for more information. That's fwp.mt.gov/AIS. Zooloft Construction from Fargo, North Dakota is your trusted partner when it comes to protecting and enhancing your property. Servicing the surrounding area for over 40 years, they've built a reputation for delivering exceptional roofing, siding, gutter, and window solutions. With a team of skilled professionals using quality brands and products, that's how they ensure lasting results. To sum it up, Zooloft Construction is committed to exceeding customer expectations. If you want an appointment for a free estimate, check out Zooloft Construction at their website, zooloftconstruction.com, or call them at 701-630-0197. All those contacts are in the description of this podcast. Check out the Flopbox bait coolers from Flop Industries. The Flopbox 10 and Flopbox 20 are heavy-duty, roto-molded bait coolers, fully insulated, which comes into play both summer and winter. The aeration system for minnows and other live bait is fully enclosed and lithium-powered for reliability and durability. The stainless hardware, the removable chill plate, the list goes on of features, but these high-end bait coolers can easily enhance your fishing experience when you consider their ability to keep your bait alive, fresh, and ready to go when you need it. Check out the Flopbox bait coolers and more at flopindustries.com. That link is in the description of this podcast. JT Outdoor Products has created a phenomenal lineup of technique-specific rods built entirely to give any angler the advantage against a tournament field, or more importantly, the target species of the day. For any angler that is looking to take their next fishing experience to another level, consider the confidence you might have with a JT rod in your hands. For more information on all the rod offerings at JT, head to their website. That's jtodp.com. That link is in the description of this podcast. Also on the website, take the time to look up the impressive pro staff that JT has put together and find out why so many top industry pros, from tournament anglers to fishing guides across the Midwest, swear by the rods built at JT Outdoor Products.
I've been hounding you for like almost a month now to do another podcast. So here we are. That being said, though, so I appreciate the time. But that being said, I do want to get, you know, just kind of like the whole, what's the synopsis, man? Like, well, we'll do some deep dives into some other things. But what's the big looking back so far on the open water tourney season, fishing season for you, man? What are the notables? What comes to mind? What can you get us caught up on?
It's been a lot of fun. You've been able to keep track of me either by looking at the top of the leaderboard in some or the very bottom in others. There's not much in the between, which is fine. But the Northern tournament season is so condensed and short that by the time you get going, you blink and all of a sudden 10 tournaments have gone by and you're in the winter doldrums again, and we're on the tail end of everything right now. But it's been a fun little whirlwind. I haven't been able to get up many videos yet, but I intend to now that we're going to start easing off of the tournament scene and probably just recap a lot of those events or what I've learned and takeaways that can help people, you know, become better through what I've learned along the way. So that'll help make up for the gap in video content. But it's been a lot of fun fishing these tournaments, and I've got to spend a lot of time out west on the Missouri River, which you will get zero complaints from me on. That is such a special system from top to bottom, and I hate passing up an opportunity to get out there and play out there.
I feel like the last time we talked, you know, part of our conversation was like, well, you know, I mean, first and foremost, you're a family man, and you do some guiding, you work closer to home. Ultimately, tournament fishing is, you know, something you kind of do with, you know, the little bit of surplus, you know, time and resources that you have. And then all of a sudden, boom, like Joe here, like all these different tournaments. Tell me, how did that kind of go for you? Like, what was, I'm trying to think of the first tournament that you fished, and then, yeah, like, how did this whole season go? Because, man, you've just been, like, on the go.
I started with the, you know, fishing some of the AIM tournaments, specifically the River Division and one or two Wisconsin events. And those are close to home within a couple hours. So they're, you know, low overhead, low time commitment, same amount of focus and preparation and commitment towards, but it's just a little easier to sneak away and try to do those. And then some of the bigger ones I wanted to do, you know, included, well, it was my first, Fort Peck was on my bucket list for many, many years to actually get out and fish. We've always sponsored an event, the Montana Walleye Governor's Cup out there. And I've always wanted to make, you know, cast a line out there and got a good taste there, but I was saving some of my extended trips for some of these fun places, you know, whether it's out at Erie or on the other side of the country out in the Missouri River, just places I don't get to visit frequently that have huge populations of fish that are fun to play with, and that's why I set my sights on those this year. But like you said, it's just a whirlwind, because you get home and you just get everything, you know, you get back on your feet, and before you know it, you're headed somewhere else, which is totally fine. It's a lot of fun to always have your sight set on the next thing.
Well, we know you're from Wisconsin, but now, you know, the Sakakawea tournament early on in the year that you fished was that AIM National Championship, which you qualified for the year prior. So you knew you were coming out to fish that. I learned that about you, having you on this spring. You were looking forward to that tournament.
Oh yeah.
And then, fast forward a little bit, get into what would it have been the first part of July, or mid July, the Montana Governor's Cup comes around, and I'm like on your social media and putting two and two together, and you're out, day one of the Montana Gov Cup kind of comes in, and I'm checking the weights because I'm all about it. And I'm like, Joe Akata's leading the tournament. Like I did. And I was so like this light bulb started going off. And, I, you know, again, just like just right away, I was just like thinking in my head, like,
I want to do a podcast. And then fast forward again, like you're, you know, like not even realizing you were down for it, but then you traveled out and fished the NWT that was on Sakakwe again. So you just did this whole, like you're from over East. And next thing you know, like we're hosting you out here, you know, in North Dakota and Montana, like three times in one season. And again, you know, just when I watch your content and stuff like that, I was like, I got to do a podcast with Joe. I got to take this opportunity. I don't know when he's going to fish, you know, the Missouri River system three times in a season, a tourney season ever again. And I respect your opinion a bunch. I think it'd be really, really cool if we talked about it, talk about, you know, these away games for you, so to speak, where you come out west here and, you know, and for Peck, you know, as you said in your, you know, your social media post, if anybody wasn't paying attention, you know, when you were fishing the Montana Govs Cup, you know, or Governor's Cup, you know, I want to hear that story, but just realizing that that was your first time ever fishing Fort Peck. And you have a little limited, experience on Sakakawea too. Like, I kind of want to get into this like right away and just start recapping and sort of talk about your breakdowns of the water. And really I've got like a mass of questions, but I really just want to throw it at you like that. Like that was the big inspiration is like, I'll talk to Joe Okada about anything. Honestly, I will. But I feel like I really need to have you talk about this year, your experiences, the stories, and just the fishing interpretations and observations you had, things you learned, maybe lessons, or just the fun you had fishing the Sakakawea and the Fort Peck tournaments, man. So that's my big like premise. That's my big build up. So go with it, Joe, man. What do you got for us?
I've been fishing the Missouri River system since 2008. That was my first time going out to Bismarck for an FLW championship. And ever since then, and anybody that you have on the podcast that talks about the Missouri River system, it's what's unique about that place is even if you go out there, or you have the ability to go out there with a completely open mind, and just look for fish, which sounds crazy, but around here, whether it's some of my inland lakes or, you know, places like Green Bay or other very structure oriented or structure driven fisheries, you have predetermined dinner tables where it takes a lot of time and understanding to learn these dinner tables and how life works with those areas. And then when you go out to the Missouri River system, even if you don't know necessarily where all that is taking place, you're using your electronics to just gauge life and look for life and look for how fish are setting up, and then just create a pattern off of that that you can then run free with. Even if you're going to fish places you've never fished before on tournament day, as long as the setup is similar, it's very unique. And so, like I said, 2008 was my first time there, and I recognize this where you're purely fishing fish, and I don't know if I'm explaining it right, but as long as you're always in hunt mode, you know, you can always come across new life or life that's moved and relocate them. And that's one special thing about that Missouri River system is the, you know, local knowledge is great and decades of experience on those bodies of water puts odds in your favor. But if you're just going out there blind, just putting your trust in your ability to hunt down fish is fun, because then you just you fish free and it's fun, you know. Like for example, when we get out to Montana, I had a day and a half to practice, which ended up just being a little less than that. So the first 5 hours of going out there, I literally stayed on plane at 20 something miles an hour and just drove and drove and drove and zigzagged and just constantly taking mental notes and gauging densities of life as you're coming in and off of breaks or going out into open water or encountering certain points with certain shoreline features and bait, how bait was setting up on things. And so density of life was the first thing I just wanted to say, for this lake, what's a good representation of a lot of activity? And then once I kind of was able to gauge density of life, then I went back to some of those areas that looked a little more promising than others, and just dropped my forward-facing transducer down and looked around and saw how fish were interacting with bait and where they were set up and what part of the water column they were favoring. And then it came down to, what do they show a good response to? And then you can start playing with different presentations. But that's the presentations were not the most important part. It was just, figuring out where the right life was. And once I thought I had a general clue, I didn't put much pressure on myself to do much, because it was my first time out there. You just go with what you've observed, and it turned out pretty good. We had an 11 pound average at the end of the tournament.
Well, yeah, there's a whole story to it too, but I'm curious about that. A day and a half of pre-fish, and I should definitely talk about who you were fishing with. I got a your fishing partner out there at the Montana Gov Cup, Brett King. I have been, scheduling this podcast is like, it can be brutal at times. I got to get that guy on. Years are going by that I got to have Brett King on. I feel like he's got a lot of, probably some good nuggets, some good conversations in him that I got to get to. But
he could write a book.
Yeah, he's been around a bit,
but his book would be pretty awesome and genuine. So
I'm curious about all that backstory of a day and a half of pre-fish, and you go up to the Montana Govs Cup, where it's just like all these Governor's Cup tournaments out here are just laced with, the best local talent, and they're all destination tournaments now. Going to Fort Peck, Lake Oahe down in South Dakota, Dewey's down there tearing that up. And then, but I mean, it's, those tourney fields are just loaded. And then in the North Dakota Govs Cup is never been a cup of tea for anybody, right? It's tough. It's competitive as can be. And you're not going out there all the way from, where you're from over in Wisconsin. You're not going all the way over there to fish with Brett King just to, for a haircut. So how did it come to where you get a day and a half of practice, which ain't much? There's probably no less than 10% of that field in that tournament had so few hours of pre-fish into that tournament. I'm so curious about the whole story leading up to it.
A lot of your audience probably, maybe against hearing it, but my active target is the equalizer when it comes to going to new bodies of water, because you can, you're able to go in there with the handicap of lack of knowledge of the fishery, but still be able to see with your own eyes, what you need to see. And if you get a good response from what you're liking and seeing with the presentations that you're, hoping is working there, then it all comes together. And so I really, as much of a negative tone that technology has brought in and all the drama that has come along with it this year, it truly is an equalizer for people that have limited knowledge of a place to quickly find something that will get you there,
Yeah.
Because without all that feedback and without truly knowing what's below the waterline and how it's set up below the waterline, you're at the mercy of, you're more at the mercy of pure experience and intuition on that body of water, which takes a long time to develop. And when you don't have that, just being, I never caught a fish in practice. Brett caught a 22 incher and, but I got a sniff from one of the biggest walleyes I've ever seen in my life on active target, on a little glide bait. And I was like, okay, if I can do this five times, we have a shot. a day to win. So that's all I needed. So I went into the tournament not having caught a four-peck walleye yet. And then on tournament day, they bit. And the crazy thing was the fish we caught, I mean, two of them were close together, but the rest of them were miles apart from each other. And you just had to, you just had to clash with a fish that was primed and ready, you know, looking for something. And, but it was painful during that hour or whatever it took in between encounters to just say, keep pushing. Something will pop up, And then sure enough, something was there, you know, and so, yeah, I pretty much attribute anything that we did out there or any place I go new nowadays to just, you know, how being able to interact with those fish visually.
From a tournament aspect, it's an abbreviated, or what anybody would consider an abbreviated pre-fish, but you're already kind of explaining, explaining that where you can work so fast, but it's such, you know, the question of that is like, or the rebuttal is like, but it's such a giant reservoir.
Huge. I never even went up one of the main arms because we didn't have time.
I feel like that's part of it. And not to say that, you know, just because you were leading after day one meant that you had completely conquered the whole lake or anything like that. But, you know, you come off of the, you know, like that AIM championship on Sakakawea, you know, you guys had very strict rules to not even have information, or that you couldn't even get outside information. But then, you know, talking about the Montana Govs Cup, that, you know, that doesn't operate on those kind of rules. But I like, again, just talking about, like, I respect you as an angler big time because I feel like you are one of those guys that you are comfortable in your own skin just showing up to a giant brand new body of water, a capital fishery that has so much history for so many people, but you're just comfortable in your own skin showing up with your skills, you know, your skills in your book bag, so to speak. You just step off the bus and, you know that you're not intimidated, you know, to in a crippling way. You know, you're not talking about, you know, just the struggle of it all, or, you know, singing the, you know, the blues, or being a victim that you didn't have, you know, 7 days of pre-fish. Like it just sounds like you were comfortable with all this. I find that, I just don't want to breeze over that. I feel like that's part of it, is like, that's what makes you, you know, you and maybe the handful of other guys that can operate that way. Especially talking about forward sonar, you know, it's a new technology still, you know, there's so much information, you know, splashing the industry, but at the end of the day, you know, you weren't baptized in forward sonar. Like 99% of your fishing career, you know, has happened without the existence of it. So I still just find this, I just find it awesome, you know, that we're having this conversation like this. But the breakdown of, like, when you're going to Fort Peck, or just, you know, just the idea that you're going to a giant destination, it's your first time on that body of water. You have your skills in tow. You have, you know, just philosophy and memories that aren't going to get in your way, but are going, you know, you're going to use them to your benefit from, you know, maybe some relatable fishing. You know, maybe we can talk about that a little bit, but like, how did you decide how much of Fort Peck, like how did you decide how to sort of section it off and say, this is how I have to spend my time for the next day and a half? You know, how I'm going to spend my time in this particular area, how much of that, you know, on plane driving you got to do. And then how do you balance your time when you're going back through those areas to check on those signs of life? And how fast do you feel like you got to work through that to find out if it's even productive? And then after a day and a half, you're going into the, you know, day one of the tournament. Like, you know, do you even feel like you're like, where did you feel like you were stacking up? Or do you even feel that way? Do you even try to put something in your head of like, well, am I actually fishing to win, or do I got to keep looking? Like, I'm just sort of curious about all of that. Still talking about the pre-fish and just how you approach all those things.
We did have a pulse on the bike going, I mean, you visit with people, you know, at the boat ramp or when you get into town, and everyone was crying. Everyone that we talked to was crying the blues about how tough it was. And that was almost a blessing in disguise, because if it was a big slugfest and everybody's just crushing, what I found, I would have been very uncomfortable going into the tournament with, like, man, I hear everybody's putting it together, but I haven't seen it. But yeah, with the knowledge that it was really tough, it would almost put my mind at ease. And after enough driving, I saw it with my own. I did a big enough lap in the main arm there, where I said, either I completely missed something, or life is really this spread out. And with it being so tough and life being so spread out, I know that if it's our day, we'll encounter five of these bigs that I just got sniffed at, and we'll be in good shape. But even before forward facing sonar, when I remember a tournament, it was over a decade ago, where I was still utilizing sonar. Like I said, you're always just hunting fish. You fish what you see. So I would I would have six or eight slip bobbers lined up on the back of the boat, all set at different depths, depending, you know, but you'd cross points at consistent depths. And so when I would go over a herd of fish, if it was a 12 or 16 foot herd of fish, I'd keep the boat going forward, but I'd just deploy my slip bobbers behind the boat with the bales open. And so I'd have like a line, like a jug line of slip bobbers to go over, and hope that I plopped it right on the pod. And if a bobber didn't go down, I'd just keep going. And if a bobber went down, I'd come back with bottom bouncers or something and try to be a little more thorough. But I've really never gone out to the Missouri River and not tried to utilize, you know, my electronics to what they're capable of doing. But this just makes it so so much easier now.
Yeah.
But I've never not gone out there with a hunting mentality. But what I was surprised about with Fort Peck, after coming out, Sakakawea is just an absolute playground. There are so many walleyes on Sakakawea, and I was hoping to see something similar, where if you screw up on a fish or it's not in the right mood, don't worry, just move up another 100 feet and you'll see what you want to see again. But Fort Peck was a different thing. And what I did notice was there's the Ciscos were everywhere. But there wasn't a lot of fish engaging with the Ciscos. I don't know if they feed at night. I don't know if it's I still don't know why I didn't see a lot of feeding activity happening. So it was hard to use the bait as a pinpoint to say, okay, here's a congregation of bait. Now let's just look for the active packs that are feeding in them. That didn't happen. You were just looking for the ones that, I mean, every fish I caught was puking up Ciscos when you brought them in the boat. So they were eating something recently, but you just had to look for the, I mean, you just had to literally just hunt down.
Taylor, can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you now.
Sorry, my ear pod just died, so.
That's all right. That's all right. But yeah, you're hunting down individual fish out there.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. And that'll probably always be my mindset. You know, well, it always will be my mindset going out there, just minus the trolling. But to some degree, I think that you could put together a pretty solid trolling program if you just know, you know, approximately where a decent number of fish are and kind of where they're relating in the water column. And you can probably put the odds in your favor by putting multiple baits in the water. But I mean, if you're trying to win that thing, you literally just have to seek out the five biggest ones you can find in a day and try to get them to bite. And if they do, it's your day. If not, you'll fall.
Zooloft Construction from Fargo, North Dakota is your trusted partner when it comes to protecting and enhancing your property, servicing the surrounding area for over 40 years. They've built a reputation for delivering exceptional roofing, siding, gutter, and window solutions.
with a team of skilled professionals using quality brands and products. That's how they ensure lasting results. To sum it up, Zuloft Construction is committed to exceeding customer expectations. If you want an appointment for a free estimate, check out Zuloft Construction at their website, zuloftconstruction.com, or call them at 701-630-0197. All those contacts are in the description of this podcast. The fishing opportunities across the state of Montana are phenomenal. If you're from there or you've already been there a bunch to experience it, you know just how special these opportunities are. If you haven't, fishing out west should absolutely be on your bucket list. But aquatic invasive species like zebra mussels and Eurasian water milfoil can harm recreational opportunities. As boaters, as anglers, we have the ability to help protect Montana's waters by cleaning all mud, plants and debris off our boat, recreational equipment, and fishing gear before we leave any access sites. Drain the water from your motor, your live well, your bilges, and allow your boat and equipment time to dry before your next outing. No matter what watercraft you use, please, if you're traveling in the state of Montana, stop at all inspection stations. Together, we can protect Montana's waters. Visit the link in the description of this podcast for more information. That's fwp.mt.gov/AIS. Check out the Flopbox bait coolers from Flop Industries. The Flopbox 10 and Flopbox 20 are heavy-duty, roto-molded bait coolers, fully insulated, which comes into play both summer and winter. The aeration system for minnows and other live bait is fully enclosed and lithium-powered for reliability and durability. The stainless hardware, the removable chill plate, the list goes on of features, but these high-end bait coolers can easily enhance your fishing experience when you consider their ability to keep your bait alive, fresh, and ready to go when you need it. Check out the Flopbox bait coolers and more at flopindustries.com. That link is in the description of this podcast. JT Outdoor Products has created a phenomenal lineup of technique-specific rods built entirely to give any angler the advantage against a tournament field, or more importantly, the target species of the day. For any angler that is looking to take their next fishing experience to another level, consider the confidence you might have with a JT rod in your hands. For more information on all the rod offerings at JT, head to their website. That's jtodp.com. That link is in the description of this podcast. Also on the website, take the time to look up the impressive pro staff that JT has put together and find out why so many top industry pros, from tournament anglers to fishing guides across the Midwest, swear by the rods built at JT Outdoor Products. So again, when you're going out there and you're breaking that down, you know, for a tournament strategy, like, I'm still just so fascinated by you. You just had to get sniffed by one fish in pre-fish to gain confidence in what your arsenal was going to be.
I literally looked back at Brett after that happened and I said, hey, we're good.
So in pre-fish, what did you need to figure out? Like, what was the thing that you needed to figure out? Like, how, like what was the math? Like, I know that, you know, like, tournament fishing is a big time management deal. It can almost be broken down into like a math equation. We could talk math instead of fishing, like math metaphors. Like, what was the part of the equation from a tournament strategy aspect that you needed to figure out, that like the most important thing that you felt like you were trying to figure out right up until the end of your pre-fish?
Well, within the first 5 minutes of driving, I drove across a deep rocky point that didn't even show up on the contours that of the mapping I was using, but I just drove over it, and there was three hooks on it, and this is at 20 miles an hour. If you with your 2D cone and you're driving on plane at 20 miles an hour and you see three big hooks, you're only seeing a fraction of what was really there. There's way more to the story there than what you just saw. So if you're able to see a good batch of life show up on 2D on plane, you waypoint it, you can come back, and all of a sudden you're like, yeah, there's more to this. There's more to it here than meets the eye. But that was the only spot where I saw a wolf pack of them. but then as far as other than that, the waypoints were pretty much, you know, if I came across other deep transitions or deep rocky points like that, I just mark them, even if they didn't have a lot of life on them. Cause you hope that what you saw earlier was part of a pattern. And if the pattern is that, I think it was about a 25 foot rock point. So, I ended up, you know, starting to tighten up my passes as I'm driving in and off these brake lines to about that 18 to 30 foot of water area, and just kept tightly weaving in and out. And you're, like I said, you're just fishing fish. So at that point, your waypoints are consisting of, you know, fish encounters versus where you actually caught a fish. Cause you didn't catch a fish there doesn't mean it's not going to be ripe for you when it's time to really need it to work. And so then once I did slow down and start just graphing with my forward facing, if I saw the right marks, if I saw the right marks, all I do is just put a reference waypoint down. It's not even on the exact spot, but that way, and yet I use different colors to represent different types of encounters, whether it's a different part of the water column or whatever. I have color coded waypoints set up so that when I see it show up on tournament day, even if I never caught a fish there, I remembered what the setup was. And then you can zoom out and look at those waypoints that are color coded and start to run patterns based on those different types of encounters if something starts to pop. And, but anyways, I just kind of got lucky in that, like I said, in that first 5 minutes of seeing where at least one group of life was primed. And then, so then as you start looking, your mind's going, do I need to go up into 3 feet of water and look at weeds? Do I need to go out to the abyss and look out extra deep? So as soon as that first little nugget was given to me, I kind of started to hone in on that and then get tighter and tighter. And then eventually you've got a milk run of, you know, 6 to 12 spots that you can just kind of cycle through. And by spots, I mean stretches, you know, that could be well over a mile long that you just start to hone in on. And like I said, with that limited practice and the tough bite, you know, I wasn't asking for a whole lot more. I felt like I had a shot if things remained stable. But then if conditions changed, and I don't know how fish move up or down in there, but if conditions would have drastically changed, that's where local knowledge would have come to say, hey, yeah, these deep rockfish, they'll slide up into this band of water under these conditions if the light changes or a storm comes through or whatever. But thankfully it didn't. It stayed really consistent. So the fish held where I found them, and you just had to kind of lock in on that for 2 days.
So. Yeah. So then day one, let's kind of go through day one a little bit out there again, because I just feel like you got to just be absorbing all this information. But now it's like tourney day, so there's some, you know, there's some emotions behind these fish catches, and again, referencing that part of the story where you didn't even catch a fish personally during pre-fish. You got a sniff on a small glide bait, as you say. Now, going into day one, what did that really mean to you? Like, what, like, did you know something about like the mood of the fish or what they, you know, what they were going to bite on? Like, did you just feel like you had confidence in that specific bait and that was what you were going to use the whole time?
No, not at all. I still had 10 rods out in a rotation, because right, every fish is different, you know. And if you see a fish glued to bottom, or if you see a fish that's a high floater, you know, you're going to, you know, don't pigeonhole yourself based on what happened the day before. Just address each fish as a new fish, as if you've got no knowledge and you're just assuming this would be the right delivery for that fish. And so, like I said, you know, the lack of knowledge I have out there, I wish I could take that same mentality I need to start taking that same mentality everywhere I go. It's just, it gets harder and harder to do the more history you develop with a body of water. You know, when I'm on Green Bay, I know if I veer off in this direction or veer to the right, my chances of encountering a fish is three times as high if I veer to the right than the left. So I'll, I'll avoid going left. But what if you didn't know, you know, and you veered left, right, and all of a sudden you see that pod that's floating out in that pot of alewives, and you're like, oh, look, there's some fish out there. I'll go catch them. And but me, I would just, you know, I'd have to really fight to turn left when I know and I see this cluster of waypoints on my graph from 20 something years of fishing out there that I should probably veer right if I want to maximize my chances of hopefully encountering the right fish. And out there, I didn't know whether to turn right or left. So I just ran around like a chicken with my head cut off until I saw something that looked right. And
yeah, and you caught like almost 60 pounds or something like that the first day. I mean, it's a conversion deal, but walk me through day one, you and Brett. What was the whole vibe like at takeoff? What was, you know, whatever you're willing to share anyways, like your strategy and like what was the discussions like between the two of you? What were you like prepared to do? What was the setup?
We just wanted to start off. We had really low expectations, honestly. And we had a super awesome excuse. You know, if we bomb in this thing, we could just say, hell, we've never been here before.
Right.
And, but no, we just wanted to get a couple fish in the boat. And if we just got a clue, you know, then that would be just fine. So I went right to where I got that sniff the day before. There was zero life there. And instead of bolting to the next group of waypoints that I made, I just kept going up, you know, I just kept meandering up the shoreline. I just saw one nice fish glued to bottom. But he was kind of meandering around a little bit, like he was still active, just very tight to bottom. So I lobbed on his head and it bit, and it was a 30 and a half incher, I think. And I was like, oh my God, this is Fort Peck is so cool. And Brett and I high-fived, and by the time I got up on the front of my trolling motor, there was another one sitting there, and I was like, no way. So then I caught that one. We had two fish in our live well, and we did out there, they have these way boats, so you can just, you know, for the sake of the fish, you know, you can immediately take your fish in to process them and let them go right away, so they're not cooking in a live well all day, which is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So, and these, you know, I think that first fish was 25 foot. The second fish was right around there, 25 or 30 foot. And, you know, they're not, I don't care how good of a live well or live well management system you have in place. Big fish are vulnerable in a live well. And it's summertime, it's hot water. Just so we just ran to the way boat, and he's like, man, these are really big ones. I was like, yeah, that's cool. It's Fort Peck. They're all supposed to be big, right? So we processed them, ran right back, started looking through there, and there was nothing. And
like no walleye marks, but you know, talking about like everything that you had been processing during pre-fish, like all the other signs of life, you know, like I'm still curious about all this information that you're inevitably gathering, because you're only like two sleeps into being there. So
I'm just glad we got out there. I broke a U-joint as I was backing into Brett's house to pick him up. So we spent all night trying to take apart some other Dodge and use its U-joints to put in mine. Thankfully, his next-door neighbor, Will, is a top-tier mechanic. So he was underneath some old Dodge taking their parts apart to try to fit it in mine. We realized that they're not quite the same assembly, so then we had to wait till the next morning and make a trip to auto parts. Well, anyways, long story short, we got all that fixed, but we were really late getting out. We were just happy to be out there by that time. And so all those things coming together probably were a net benefit to us. The lack of knowledge, you know, we didn't owe a spot anything. We didn't owe a presentation anything. You don't, and people that practice for extended periods of time, you can't help but feel like you owe that a shot in order to not kick yourself at the end of the day if you have a bad day.
Yeah. I love, this is the part that I love, dude. Like, this is the stuff that no one ever talks about, you know? And it's the same thing if you're not fishing a tournament. If you just have, if you're on your home body of water, you inevitably have so many memories somewhere where you've caught a fish with your grandpa or whatever, that you never go somewhere without just having to pay homage to make one or two pass. You know, we just all manage our time so poorly based on memory. So I love that when you say that. You didn't owe a spot anything.
I would give anything for a tournament organization. In 2021, I fished a tournament circuit that had a no information rule. You know, you got 2.5 or 3 days of practice, and then you just had to fish by the seat of your pants for 4 days straight. And my brain never functioned better than that year. Like, you just fished free. You just kept pushing on new bodies of water that you're unfamiliar with. And you just kept going. And my brain works best when I'm able to do that. What I really should, you know, I'm thinking Green Bay specifically. When I go to Green Bay, it is so, I have thousands and 6,000 waypoints on my graph of 20 years of history, you know, and it's so hard to not just drive to a clump of waypoints because you did good there in the past, instead of saying, here's how the day is set up. Here's some patterns, or I've recognized some patterns that have developed this morning already. Let's just keep going from there and build your day off of what you're taking in that moment, instead of relying on history and lots of preparation through extended practice periods. I don't like that. I just wish a tournament organization would come back and send us the new bodies of water that have us way out of our comfort zone, and you just fish by the seat of your pants, because that's when I do the best.
Yeah, man. So out on Peck, you're two fish into day one. I mean, now the vibe's got to be good in the boat, but what are some of the fishy conversations that Joe Okada and Brett King are having at this stage of day one?
by that part of day one, Brett was a super good sport, because a lot of the techniques we're doing now are one person roles. Mm-hmm. You know, two person if you get into a groove and you can team up on fish, you know, in, you know, certain ways. But for the most part, he would just be patient and totally mindful of my focus on just staring down at the bow of my boat all day. And when I hit the brakes, he would make a cast and try to pluck an extra fish, or a fish that he saw that I didn't see, or something like that. But he wouldn't chirp at me once I got going. I ramp up at 2 miles an hour or more just to start looking for the next one. And, you know, sometimes he didn't get to finish a cast or whatever, but he was such a good compliment in the boat, you know, just to keep good energy in the boat and not throw me any curveballs as I'm just trying to plow through water and find the next fish. So he was a super good sport. And I'd fish that tournament with him anytime.
So the day, as it's progressing, was there anything else that you were paying attention to that was sort of, that gave you any expectation? Was there something to do with bite windows, or were you observing anything else? Like, how far between fish, how far between casts? Like, what did it take to get the third and fourth fish in the boat?
That just took a total relocation and some luck. I was actually that last fish we pulled that off by the skin of our teeth. My batteries had died by then because I had just run them ragged, and I had just enough juice to turn my boat. I said, Brett, I can't get to that fish. Push me up there. So he starts the Yamaha and pushes me up.
No way.
About 50 feet, and the wind was started to crack by then. So I had zero mobility up front. I'm like, just push me a little further. I said, kill it. And I just made a Hail Mary 70-foot cast on this fish. A little bink spoon of fish was sitting on the bottom, and just two hops, and he inhaled it, and I was like, I got him. And these things fight like bonefish out there. These big ones, they just peel drag, and I can't chase the fish down. I'm just pulling away from the fish because the wind's blowing me down. But we got it in. I was like, dude, we got five fish. Well, you know, that was a huge achievement, since we only caught one in, you know, a couple days of fishing out there. And so we were high five, and they were all huge. We're like, I think we should be at least in it by for tomorrow.
So you only caught five.
Yep.
Day one. You only caught five. And how many different presentations did it take?
It was, well, just two caught the fish. It was either glide baits or a little big spoon. That was it. But I threw everything at them, and I had really good encounters, you know, doing other presentations. Just didn't get, they just weren't quite ready to commit, or I didn't have the magic move with that presentation to finish the deal. But they just seemed a little picky. So you just had to come across one just right and make it eat. They weren't willing to chase very far, for sure.
So how many fish do you feel like you remember encountering or casting on that first day to get those five bites?
Probably 10.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And in how long? What time of day did you catch that fifth?
I want to say about 1 o'clock. One or two o'clock.
One or two o'clock. So pretty much the full tournament day. Because what you probably hit, you were head till what, 3 or 4 o'clock or something.
Yeah. So that puts you at about like once every half hour or so, you have a shot at a fish. If you were to average the numbers out there.
I'm stuck on the fact, like I said, you got an abbreviated pre-fish, but you're a smart guy. You know how to use your gear. So you obviously you put together your strategy. Okay, I get all that, but still. You know, going through day one, was there anything that was maybe a surprise, good or bad, with maybe how big the fish were? Obviously, that was a plus, right? You guys had an awesome bag, but it was only five bites, and you know, you're literally talking about casting at, you know, 10 or so fish in that entire time. Like, was there anything about day one that was, you know, a big light bulb going off?
No, we were super happy to not completely suck. And so like it was a relief after day one, but then day two, I've actually felt really good going into day two. Cause if you get that many encounters, you know, that's you're targeting 30-inch class fish. I wasn't casting at smaller walleyes. And if you get that many encounters with that caliber of fish in a day, that's a success in my opinion.
Yeah.
And and once I saw how tough it was for everybody that day, I said, I don't care if we get 50% of the encounters tomorrow. I think we still have a shot if I can just get them to go.
Mm-hmm.
And,
so how many fish do you feel like, you know, and this is kind of a fish pattern question, but like, were these big fish completely isolated? Like you weren't seeing many other smaller walleyes at all, or did you kind of have to really dial in like that, you know, interpreting that size structure because maybe you were seeing a good amount of smaller walleyes? Maybe, you know, talking about that fish pattern with all the fish, even the undesirables, what was that like?
You could, we found some concentrations of smaller fish up along the edges of some weeds and then tucked up in this one little cove. Or I don't know if it's considered a cove. I don't know what you would call it, but you just look at them and you remember what you started the day with, you know, visually seeing the size of these fish. And you're like, they're just not, those aren't the ones. You can't waste your time playing with them, you know, when you still need to go get a few more of those bigger bites. And if you're only, you know, your whole goal is to just catch Fort Peck giants. So you gotta just focus on the bigs, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah,
dude, that's not easy for people to do, man. That's, again,
it's brutal because some of the other ones, they look very ripe. Like I could throw a crawler in there and jig it along, you know, and get them to bite. I know I could have.
So you're never tempted. Like at any point in time, you were not, you're saying you were basically, I mean, you're probably tempted, but I mean, it never crosses your mind like, hey, why don't I just, those look like 20 inches. Why not just fill our card so we know we got five and then go do our upgrades, right? You hear that all the time. Why,
yep,
like the, you know, like you're not tempted so much to like actually do that.
I'm very tempted, but then you have to say to yourself, are you here to, did you just drive 18 hours to lay up or do you want to try to win the thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I, honestly, I didn't, I didn't care if we bombed or if we won. That's easy to say after you start the day with 2 30-inch class fish. But once I knew the potential that the day had for us, I didn't want anything less than that. And I would have been mad at seeing a small fish show up in the boat.
Yeah.
So it was thankful that we started the day really good so that the desperation didn't force me to cast at fish I shouldn't have cast it at. Had the day played out any differently, maybe that would have been the right move to at least stay in it, you know, and not completely bomb, which I'm very good at doing if I get stubborn and just focus on something.
Yeah. Well, that can be anybody, any star-studded tournament career that's out there has plenty of failures to go with it. And those are, like we've talked about many times on this podcast, you learn a lot from those experiences too. I mean, there's a time and a place to talk about both, but tell me about day two then. All right. Cause you know, again, if anybody that was paying attention probably has some idea of kind of how day two went, but I want you to kind of break it down. Again, you know, just you're in the boat with Brett King, legendary tournament angler, probably, you know, a longtime buddy. How long have you and Brett known each other?
15 plus years.
Yeah, you guys know each other since forever. So, I mean, again, I just got to imagine the conversation had to have been a little bit fishy. Or do you guys just operate on, like, body language and grunting noises? Like, I'm just curious, like, how do you go to bed that night? What are maybe some of the fishy conversations that you have going into day two? Or do you guys just look each other in the eye and say, all right, we're just going to run it back and do the exact same thing in the same spots? Like, how did you approach day two?
The exact same way. And I had enough stretches in the rotation that I just had a really good feeling that like I said, conditions were stable throughout the entire time we were there. Nothing was really changing. And so we went out there and the fishing was actually, it doesn't look like it on the scorecard, but the fishing was actually better in terms of how many bites we got on that second day. But it was a weird bite. Like you'd feel these fish, you'd feel a hard flick or just get tight all of a sudden, and the fish would just come off after a couple seconds. And the fish would come off and I'd look back at Brett and just have this dumbfounded look on our face, like, what just happened? And then it happened again and again and again. And no adjustment I could make was able to get fish to stay on. We got one in the boat. It was like a 32.5-incher.
Unbelievable
and
fish.
Just a giant. And that made my day. And then I was like, okay, we can do this. And then the rest of those fish just were in this crazy mood where it was I would call it a curiosity bite. The day before it was down in their gills, and the next day it was just this curiosity nip. And I don't know if it was a skin hook or I don't know if they were swatting at it with their, I don't know what was going on. Maybe my hooks were so dull from the day before that they just did, but I'm just kidding. They were all brand new hooks. But,
yeah.
But I don't know what the deal was, but they didn't get in the boat and we totally bombed. But it was still an eventful day because the fish were willing to engage, but not all the way. It was crazy. I mean, hindsight, yeah, I would have loved to have tried a couple other things.
Like what?
I probably would have locked a jig in a jig in a chub or a jig in a crawler or something in my hand more of the day and just let those fish eat it better instead of just throwing reaction baits at them and hoping they go crazy ham on those. And that's probably one thing that I would have done. And after playing on Sakakawea this past, what was it, a couple of weeks ago, I got to play with so many fish out there with jigs and live bait that I'm already more comfortable with that Missouri River fish playing with that than I was even before Fort Peck. I've just learned so much in the past 2 months of playing out there that I would love to go back out there and give it a shot.
Yeah, because what do you do? You're no stranger to maybe getting a little bit finessey, right, to get a big fish to bite, you know, in other places that you fish. But at the same time, you only get like a handful of opportunities on a tournament day. So like when you burn one, like how, really, it's probably just as important to forget about, a fish that got off. You almost got to forget about it to go into the next fish with more confidence, or don't let it hit you like psychologically. But you know, it's like, how do you justify making some big presentation adjustment, like one fish to the next?
And it's hard out there because like your frequency of encounters are so low. We're so low. I'm sure people were saying this is the worst fishing they've seen in all their years of being out at Fort Peck and blah, blah, blah. And, I was happy with what I saw just cause I don't get to play with that class of fish very often. When you know that maybe an hour down the road, you'll get another shot. It's hard to say, well, let me just try this time. Let me just try this. You almost just kind of want to lock some confidence in your hand. Yeah. And if the setup is the same as it was the day before, why not put the odds in your favor and try to make that one bite? That goes back to prior knowledge inhibiting your flow for the day, because now I'm saying, well, this worked yesterday, and look, there's another. So right there, that's a hamper on your ability to just open up and try stuff. But then again, that it's hard, especially.
But then what do? You lighten up your jig so that they can breathe it in better. But then you're fishing in 35, 30 foot of water, 25 foot of water. How do you watch an 1/8 ounce jig with a half a crawler? When the Fort Peck waves are out there, you wait 2 minutes for it to get to the bottom and that fish is a half mile away. It's like all those little things. It's like a really hard thing to justify, but it is interesting to talk about them in hindsight, not by the purpose of to beat yourself up. Right. But just I think, you gain a lot of perspective. I learn a lot from it. So if I cast that, a couple of big fish that get me excited, on a summer pattern on Sakakawea, or if I'm out on Peck, and just learning from your experience, I'll definitely, I would have to credit you, 100% in the boat if it happened. But I feel like, learning from your experience, you have to open up your mind to some of those things if possible.
Have to stay in the moment and take each fish as an individual and read that fish and make adjustments in that moment for that particular fish. And just, it's a complete mindset shift that I'm working through on so many different levels right now.
Oh yeah. But you guys finished top five, right?
Yeah, we got second. It was still a tough day for most of the field. Owen came in with a monster bag though, and he had a decent day the day before. So he's been playing at that tournament for a long time.
He's tough on Peck. I had him on the podcast, I think, one time. He was like, he's like baptized into walleye fishing on Fort Peck. He runs with a tough crew. And oh, yeah, dude. Yeah, yeah, totally. But, the one thing, this might be kind of our closer. The conversation around a tough bite means different things to other people. When you were hearing the grumblings at the boat landing or reading online or whatever it was, when you were interpreting people talking about the bite being tough, what ultimately do you feel like they meant, or do you feel like people were doing wrong, I guess, so to speak, or however you would say it? Like, what was making it tough for other people? Were they just not able to find fish, or were they not able to get fish to eat? Like what was the tough bite?
I think a good a good portion of that field has so much history on there that there must be key points or key rock or whatever it is that they have set up on. And if that Grand Milk Run is not firing on all cylinders, it's considered a tough bite. Yep. And these fish were extremely spread out, and they weren't lingering around or, you know, staying put, and which Cisco fish typically don't do. And that's, I really think that that is what set us up to have a decent, you know, knowing that it's tough on people, getting a glimpse that, hey, if what just happened can happen five times over the course of 8 hours, you'll be okay, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, that knowing that it was tough for others and seeing the potential that might be there if it's your day, it just put us at ease to go have a fun couple days on the water. And that's, and I really want to strive to implement that mindset wherever I go, you know. And it's so hard. It's easy to say you're going to do that, but 4 hours into your day, when you're struggling and start, and the desperation is starting to kick in, it's way easier said than done. But for the, there's a handful of anglers that have that ability, and I really admire their mindsets that they're able to carry for the entire day at 100%. And that's why they always rise to the top. And it's a fun process to try to work towards.
So with like an hour and a half left on day two and you had one fish.
Holy cow, it was a quiet boat.
Did you still weren't tempted to go up in the weeds and fill your card with a bunch of 16 inches? Not at all?
No. Nope, not at all. I'm not afraid of bombing.
I love
and
it.
I'm good at it. And but sometimes that willingness to bomb turns into a blessing, and those are the ones you remember. So
yeah, dude, I don't know. I love it. I've been geeking out on this, getting this podcast done. We've been kind of going back and forth on the schedules for, like I said, like a month when we started this thing out. I've been trying to figure it out in our schedule, and I'm glad we were able to get it done, man. But that being said, we're definitely going to drag this night on along. It's a little bit too long, but anything else that hops into your mind, like that you feel like was like a big punchline from any of your trips out west, but that Fort Peck trip, you know, anything that we didn't cover, go ahead. Otherwise, we'll probably wrap this thing up.
Well, hopefully in the near future, we'll be having another visit. I've been working on a few things that I've been brutally biting my tongue on. That I think people will enjoy if we can get these things into motion. A lot of it is presentation wise or new things that I've been working on for a long time, and I'd like to get them out there. I think we're getting a little closer. So, and out there with as many, you know, regarding Sakakawea, I was able to really mess with some fun things that I've been experimenting with, and I hope we get the ball rolling on those soon, so I can share some of that with you guys, because it will be a lot of fun. So, but yeah, I'll keep you posted as that gets a little further along the line. But really enjoyed my trips out west. I can't get enough of the Missouri River. I've got a great history with that place that has taught me so much about fishing and just finding fish and fishing on the fly, and it's, I mean, those are lessons that you can take anywhere in the country and be successful with. So I just love it out there so much.
Yeah. Anything that you got going on or cooking, man, you just keep me in the loop, because I'd love to have you on anytime. Anything juicy that you got rolling around in your head, I'm all for it. So yeah, be in touch with anything you're working on for sure. That being said, if anybody isn't already, wants to follow along on your socials or your content, anything that you want to promote or throw out there so people can find you, go ahead.
I hope to be getting back to getting some video content up in the near future, so feel free to go subscribe to my YouTube channel, and if you got any questions, shoot me a message on Facebook. I'd be happy to answer anything I can. But I appreciate all the support I've received from so many people this year, and look forward to keeping the train rolling.
Joe Akata, man, it was a long time coming, finally getting you on, but I'm so glad that we were able to stay in touch and do a couple of these, man. So yeah, many, many more to come.